Hi, I'm Mark Belsman, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, the Artist Low Comedy. Starting in October 23rd and Saturday, October 28th, we'll be offering our advanced ensemble class. We limit this to 10 people, and if you want to take your long form to the next level, you need to sign up for this class. You are going to love it, and it ends with a long form performance at Stage 773 here in Chicago. For more information, go to my website, jimmycrane.com, for the more information on the Artist Low Comedy classes. Also, we're brought to you by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. So the next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, it's not only pet friendly, but it's improv friendly as well. Check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd. That's Hotel Lincoln. I'm really excited about today's guest. He's an old friend, and he really helped me out when I first started out in improv here in Chicago back in the 80s. He doesn't remember this, but he was actually my first improv director. Our guest today is renowned improv teacher, improviser, and actor, none other than Mark Belsman. In this interview, we talked to Mark about working with Barron's Barracudas, which was the first Herald team from the Improv Olympic that did Herald on a regular basis in front of an audience, and what it was like to work with Del Close and how the Herald was back then. We also talked to him about what influences and inspires his improvisation and his teaching today. This interview is also filled with such great practical advice for improvisers today. And the thing that I love about Mark and his teaching as an improviser is he simplifies it. He makes it very easy to understand. So I know you're going to enjoy this episode. Before we get to the interview with Mark, I just want to share something real quickly. My sister Molly came into town. She lives in Colorado, so she came into Chicago, or really the suburbs of Chicago, to see my parents. And she has three kids, and this trip she brought just her oldest, Maggie. And Maggie is so cute. She's in eighth grade now, and she's got braces. And we went over there, Lauren and myself, for dinner. They had pizza, even though I don't eat pizza because it's not on my food plan. And we went and we hung out with my parents, my mom and my dad and Maggie and Molly. And we like to talk about people. That's how we always bonded growing up. When we were younger and we would always have a lot of relatives over for the holidays like Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter and stuff like that. And the best part of those gatherings were when everybody would go home, all the relatives would go home, and then the immediate family would just sit around and make fun of the relatives now that they were gone. So we went over there, and Maggie, Molly's daughter, my niece, she plays ukulele. She's taking music lessons, and so she brought out the ukulele, and I'd never heard her sing before. And she had such a such a sweet voice, and she, you know, she can play. She played a couple songs. One song that I guess is on popular radio, but I'm so out of touch. I didn't know what it was. And then the other thing she did was she sang a made up song. And for me, I just felt such pride, you know, that she's pursuing an art and she's really expressing herself. The compliment I gave her, I said, when she did both songs afterwards, I said, you really can access your sadness in her music. So I'm all about sadness, aren't I? I'm always about bringing people down. But I love it when I love sad stuff. I love sad stuff. I love sad movies. I love sad music. Give me anything sad. And when my niece was singing a sad song, I loved it. All right, enough sad talk. Let's go to some more happier talk. Here it is, the Mark Belsman episode.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
So let's start with you.
Oh, I thought we were going to start with you, jizzing in a cup.
I think we've already discussed that.
All right.
Okay. You grew up in Detroit, and you were in grade school and high school, you were a really good student. And you were on the track to be a surgeon. Right?
Yeah, this is more like This Is Your Life than Improv Nerd.
Well, would you like to start somewhere else?
No. Okay. This is just fun. I'm just commenting on how exciting this
so
is.
So you
living my life, my past.
So you were going to be a surgeon.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
I found marijuana, and I was I also play the tuba. I still do to this day. So I was very involved in that in high school, and was involved in a lot of music stuff. And I started going to college, and I did the first 2 years of liberal arts. I never got to the pre-med stuff and just decided that wasn't what I wanted to do.
But you were a straight-A student, right?
I was through grade school and junior high school, I was. And then I went to a college prep school. You had to apply and have a major and a minor. And it was just like going to college, but it was high school.
And what kind of kid were you?
A lot of fun.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
I was just always, you know, kind of a class clown and always, you know, surrounded by a lot of friends and still keep in touch with a lot of those people.
So you were a pretty popular person?
I was somewhat popular. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say really
popular. Because I don't think
popular.
Like people playing the tuba in music are necessarily popular. Is that?
I think that's a myth.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not lonely guys who sit at home by ourselves mm-hmm. and practice a tuba and jizzing in a cup or anything
right.
like that.
But the tuba led you to your first acting job, right?
It did, yeah,
Can
yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, my best friend Robert Teachman, his parents had a couple of friends who were photographers, one of which Robert actually started working for, named Amin Harani, and he's responsible for my career, but ultimately. But this other guy named Charlie Schritte was another major photographer in Detroit, and he asked could he borrow my tuba for a Lazy Boy chair ad. And I said, sure. And he said, you want to be in it? And that was my first acting job. Really, I started out as a model. I did a lot of modeling back then, believe it or not.
And what kind of, when you say modeling, what was it, just like the...
Like doing the Lazy Boy chair ad with my tuba and then posing for other pictures. And then, like I said, my friend Robert Teachman worked for this guy, Amin Harani. And Amin said, do you want to do a TV commercial, which was for Highland Appliance? But it was all done in stills, so he took the still pictures. And I was Tony Baker, the high-low driver, who drove his forklift into 400 refrigerators, and they had to have a damage sale. And that ran for years, and they sold it to other markets for Steinberg's Appliance, and it ran, I can't even calculate how much money I made off
that commercial.
But
you've never had a day job, have you? I mean, from that point on?
No, I haven't done anything else other than acting, teaching for 33 years now.
So you're making money at Detroit,
mm-hmm.
in Detroit.
Doing commercials.
Doing commercials. Mm-hmm. And then how do you get introduced into improv?
I was taking an acting class, and there was a little bit of improv there. And I was really intrigued by that and wanted to study more about acting. And I read in the Detroit paper, I can't remember whether it was Detroit News or Detroit Free Press, that Del Close, this guy, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, was coming to Detroit to do a workshop. So I literally cleaned out my bank account. I don't know what it was, maybe like $300 or something back then, and paid to take Del's workshop. And that's how I met Del. And first thing he asked me was, did I know where I could get some heroin? And I said, no, I don't. No, I don't know.
But did you?
But,
did you get him high?
Yeah. I had actually, I had a big ball of hash,
okay.
And I said, hey, you know, Del Close,
right.
Fuck, you're the acting coach for the Not Ready for Primetime Players. Do you want to get high? And he's like, yeah, sure. So I pull out this ball of hash, and he pulls out a little one-hit bong out of his pocket, and he takes a ball of hash out of my hand and shoves the whole fucking thing in this little one-hit bong and lights it, and I'm just with my jaw dropped going, that's all the hash I have! And so, we got high, and it was great. This guy Jonathan Round brought him, and Jonathan Round was forming improv sketch group called the Detroit Times Theater Company. And so out of that workshop, that very first workshop, I got hired to be in the Detroit Times Theater Company, which is where I met my wonderful wife of 33 years.
Bev.
Beverly Lubin, yeah. And Timmy Meadows later was in that. Mike Maddox, Dave Floyd.
Richard Label was
Richard
in it?
Label was in it, yeah.
Okay, so you're doing that. You're doing the Detroit Times, is that what?
Detroit Times Theater Company, yeah.
You're doing that, and mm-hmm. you're cast out of this workshop from Dell.
Yeah.
And then how do you get to Chicago from there?
Michael Gelman was also brought into Detroit to do a workshop with the Detroit Times Theater Company by this guy, John Round, who spent a considerable amount of time in Chicago getting to
know these
people.
Wasn't there a joke about Jonathan Round that who was going to buy him a bowl of chili?
Well, yeah, John's real name was John Mariotto, but he was so fat, he changed his name to Round. There was this whole...
What was the joke?
Well, we performed at this place called the Soup Kitchen Saloon. So, you know, whenever he modeled it after Second City. So we would do a sketch review, and then we would take suggestions and go upstairs and do an improv set.
So you'd plan it out like Second City would do with the set?
Yeah,
and then
exactly
beat
like
it
that.
Out and then come back. Okay.
Yeah, it was great preparation for the rest of my career and actually getting into Second City eventually. But that was... And so John would always be eating a bowl of chili while we were writing the set, you know. And one day there was they replaced the actual bar in the bar. So the old bar was stuck in the stairway where we'd have to go up to the thing. And it was at an angle, and John was so fat, he couldn't get up the stairs. He had to lift up his stomach and put it on the top of the bar and slide up the stairs. And then this whole joke came about, like, you know, who was going to buy the chili, who was going to bring him the chili upstairs for him and feed him. And then afterwards, we all went to Greek Town after every show. And, you know, John, we'd all order food and share it or whatever. But John would get, you know, the platter for like four people and sit and eat it by himself.
So Gelman comes to Detroit.
Gelman came to Detroit, and he and I became friends, okay. And one day he called me and he said, "What are you still doing in Detroit? You're going to die there." And that
Did you know what he meant by that?
First of all, improv wasn't a business back then. It was just simply a passion. So unless you came to Chicago to start, you know, developing a career outside of Detroit, which was not a place that was actually going to happen over 30 years ago, and I agreed, and that motivated me to actually, I drove on Sunday morning, I would wake up and I commuted from Detroit to Chicago to take Michael Gelman's workshop for about 3 weeks. And then they took a break for the holidays. And also it was the Second City 25th anniversary, which I didn't know at that time. And when we, and I said, well, this is stupid. I'm not going to keep commuting to Chicago. So on January 5th, 1985, I actually moved into a friend's apartment here in Chicago, and that's how I got here.
And when you got here, what was your goal?
My goal was just to live, eat, and breathe improv. You know, nobody likes to get high more than I do.
Still,
yeah.
Okay. What do you like about it?
Well, I just like the euphoria and the, you know, excitement. For me, it can either take you up or take you down. There's sativa and indica, so you can go either way. What about the myth?
I don't know if it's a myth, but that people that get high, they lose motivation. What would you say to that?
What do you mean by that? No, I don't think that's true. I think you can get lazy doing anything. But my point was that there's no greater drug to me still to this day than improvisation. Mm-hmm. There's nothing more exciting than doing improv, being on a stage in front of an audience, teaching improv, talking about improv, and it's just one of the most exciting things for me that I can do bring, you know, me joy and happiness. And I think as improvisers and as addicts, we all need to feed that creative energy that is burning inside of all of us. And the improv really does that for me. It just feeds that energy of creativity that keeps you happy, excited, and motivated. So I think that is a myth, and it's now debunked.
And speaking of like an exciting time, mm-hmm. you got to, I mean, with Del Close, when
yes.
you came to the Improv Olympic,
mm-hmm.
Barron's Barracudas was the first team, if I'm not mistaken, that mm-hmm. worked on the Herald. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Barron's Barracudas wasn't the first team to work on the Herald per se. The Herald had been developed in the late 60s with the committee in San Francisco when Del was directing them. And Carl Gottlieb, who wrote and was in Jaws and is a brilliant, prolific screenplay writer to this day. And there was a bunch of people in that Herald, Howard Hessman. They invented the Herald. I think it was at the University of Austin. I talked to Carl Gottlieb about this once. He said the first time they ever did a Herald was at the University of Austin in Texas, and they were doing a show. And so the Herald was always done under the pretenses of other shows, like in the set of The Second City or in the context of some other show. But Barons Barracudas was the first group to actually do long form and have people pay money to walk through the door and just see long form improvisation.
And you were working on it every week.
Every day, essentially. I mean, Barons Barracudas, we all hung out together. We all went to the bar and drank and did tons of drugs all night long till 8 o'clock in the morning, and the sun would come up. And, it was just, we hung out at the U.S. Blues Bar, which was owned by Steve Buscegas was John Belushi's best friend. And after John died, he borrowed the money from Dan Aykroyd to open up the U.S. Blues Bar, which is Uncle Stevie's Blues Bar. And that's where we all hung out.
Now, when I started out, a lot of people would compare you to Belushi. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with it back then?
Well, I'd always had that kind of comparison. I mean, even before I started acting, actually, in high school, when people signed my yearbook, they actually signed it to Belushi, because a lot of people called me that. Because I was sort of, like I said, I was kind of popular and was a class clown, had a lot of friends, and we were all huge fans of not only Animal House, but Saturday Night Live, and John Belushi, and Dan Aykroyd, and Bill Murray, and we studied everything we could get our hands on that they did, and we watched all that stuff, and it led to studying Monty Python and Firesign Theater and, anybody from Second City, and so, we were just fans and students of the work and anything we could watch or see, and we would all talk about it. And we literally hung out 24/7. I think that's what made the, Barons Barracudas, and to this day, I think any improv group, a really strong improvisational ensemble, is people who go to dinner together, to go movies together, to just do things outside of the stage. Because what would happen is, you'd be at a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning and there would be an incident of some kind. And then a week later or a couple weeks later, you'd be on stage at Second City on a Monday night doing the Second City Touring Company show. And somebody would make a reference to that incident that happened, say, at the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the scene was already written. We just had to act it out, and everybody knew what the scene was. So even though we weren't really writing, we were still improvising. It was a reference level that we all shared. And so those kind of things, I think, is something that really strengthens an ensemble, especially when it comes to improvisation.
What was the Herald like back then when you started?
The Herald was truly long form. I mean, a minimum of 45 minutes.
Would get 45 minutes.
Yeah. And it was basically what you're carrying on the tradition of to this day, which is the art of slow comedy. So you really took your time doing stuff. If you go back and you look at the first couple seasons of Saturday Night Live, you will see scenes that go on forever. And you can drive trucks through those scenes and the pauses they did. And now everything, I think because of the advent of the internet and cell phones and technology, that everything, and stand-up comedy, of course, became very popular too, that everything has to be fast and funny and furious, and everybody's looking for the laugh, 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 and get to the next moment and get to the next beat. And that's really not what this art form is about.
What is it about?
I think it's really about exploring and heightening the relationship between two people.
And when you say that,
mm-hmm.
we kind of get it,
yep.
us generation,
mm-hmm.
but the younger generation might not get that. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is the kind of stuff that I teach. We call it improv and we call it acting, but it's just life lessons. It's stuff that you should be doing outside of the stage and outside of improvisation. The principles of life, which is make your partner look good, you look twice as good. That's what any marriage or any relationship is all about. To replace thinking with listening, to be present, to be in the moment, And, you know, those principles that you and I both teach are really what, you know, makes improvisation brilliant. It's about the moment. It's about these three points of focus come together, that you're discovering what you're saying and doing the same time your partner's discovering what you're saying and doing, the same time the audience discovers what you're saying and doing. So the audience is part of the ensemble, and they have to be in on that moment of discovery. Because if you're ahead of the audience or you're behind the audience, they're bored. And if you're doing something other than that, then you're either writing or you're directing, but you're not improvising, you're not present, and you're not being in the moment. And so those three points of focus have to come together, and every time they do, it changes the energy in the room. The audience will laugh so hard that it will stop the show. So it's not about magic. It's not about being funny. It's not about being anything other than in the moment and making that discovery with your partner and the audience at the same time.
What is the quickest way to get in the moment, to be in the moment?
To stop thinking, to replace thinking with listening.
And how do you do that? That's a great concept to say, but how do you do that?
It's exactly what we're doing right now. I listen to your questions. You're listening to my response.
Well, but I also have questions typed out here.
Okay, well, let's get rid of that shit.
Okay, great. Great.
Now what?
There
you go. That's improvisation.
We
just experienced it.
But it was like, why did the audience laugh at that?
Because we all made the discovery at the same moment. I didn't know I was going to do that. I didn't know you were going to say that. And it was in the moment that the entire room just experienced that moment of discovery.
Why can't we do more of that on stage? Because I struggle with that.
Because people are thinking. You're constantly thinking about, you're either insecure and you're thinking you're not doing enough. You're thinking that you're doing too much. You're thinking about what the audience is thinking. You're thinking about what your partner or the rest of the ensemble is thinking. Did they like that? Did they not like that? There's a moment of silence, and there's no laughs, and everybody panics. Just like right now. There's no laughs. But they're riveted.
How do you know they're riveted?
Because they're all staring at me. They're not looking at their cell phone, except for that guy's looking at his cell phone. See, he doesn't
Dan,
give...
Dan, are you looking at your cell phone?
He doesn't give Dan, a fuck who I am or about anything about this show right now.
I was going to put a picture on the Improv Nerd Facebook page.
All right, okay, that's good, that's good. Go ahead, come on up here and take the picture, it's all right.
I already took the picture.
All right.
Here, I'm supposed to take one of both of you guys.
All right.
On there.
Go ahead.
There you go, right. Perfect, there you go.
You want to do a selfie? You want to be in it? All right.
No, not at all.
So, I think it's time to improvise, don't you?
Already?
Yeah.
It's been 25 minutes?
Well, I mean, we're kind of improvised. How long have we been, Taylor?
We've been going for about 21.
21 minutes.
All right. Sure.
We can come back and ask you some more questions.
Aren't we improvising now?
I don't know.
We can take it to another level. What would you like to do?
Well, we need to get a suggestion.
All right.
Okay.
I don't like taking suggestions.
Why don't you like taking suggestions?
Because they're meaningless. It doesn't matter. If the audience doesn't believe that this is improvised, You can experience it. It's an energy thing. The audience knows if it's being improvised or not. They know. It's instinctive.
Okay, then why does every... Okay, go on.
There's a great documentary by this guy, Tom Shadyac, who's a very famous A-list director in Hollywood. He's directed tons of stuff that you guys have seen. And in this documentary, they talk about how the heart sends more information to the brain than the brain does to the rest of the body. And that just fucking rocks my world. And what that tells me is, and this is just my opinion, is that the brain is a housing for your ego. And you really do all of your thinking with your heart. So you want to get out of your head and into your heart. I know that's one of the things Rosowski teaches. David Rosowski, who's a brilliant improv teacher. And it's just about being in the moment, and it's an energy thing. So you can feel it. You know instinctively. We had this conversation a little while ago about people who are genuine and people who are not genuine.
Right. And you said, we talked about Harold Ramis. You said he was genuine.
One of the most genuine guys you'll ever meet.
And why is it that you knew that he was genuine?
Passed away.
How did you know he was genuine?
Because of it's an energy thing.
It's an instinct?
It's an instinctual thing. As an improviser and as an actor, what we do is portray other characters. So we become a good reader of other people's, how do I put that? What's the word I'm looking for? Of other people being genuine or not. I don't know. I don't know what the word is I'm looking for.
But
whether
but,
they're being real, you know.
But you're saying
or
that
sincere. That's the word I'm looking for. Whether they're being sincere or not.
And you're saying improv gives you that gift to do that.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, I believe that we exercise because we both have been doing this a long time. We exercise that muscle. You know how you go to the gym and you haven't been there in a while and that lactic acid burns for 3 days later because you use that muscle that you haven't been using. And so improv is a muscle.
I am so impressed with you. You retain so much great information. You're so articulate and you get high. How do you do it?
I'm stoned out of my mind right now.
No, you're not, are you?
No.
Okay.
It's just something, anything, I think as human beings, we remember whatever we want to remember. You remember before cell phones, how we used to know everybody's phone number?
Yes.
And now that's been replaced with passwords that you have to remember.
But you also have to program the phone number into your phone now.
Yeah, so you don't remember any of it.
Right. And if you lose it, you're screwed.
So now it's all replaced with the technology of learning how to work your computer and work your cell phone and do all that stuff. So that muscle is in there for everybody. And so we remember what we want to remember. Whatever excites us, whatever we're really passionate about, you only remember the people you want to remember. Either somebody that really pissed you off, you'll remember them, or somebody who you really love, you'll remember them. And there's tons of people that we meet that we don't remember. There's a lot of, like, I don't remember directing you, being your first director. I don't have any recollection of that. I was probably way too high.
All right, so we're not taking a suggestion. We're just going to go.
We can do whatever you want.
No. You're the guest.
No, it's your show. Look, come on.
Okay, so we're going to improvise. We're not going to take a suggestion. We're just going to go out there and do it. And I would really like to, I'd really like to practice what you're saying, replace thinking with just being. Is that what you?
Yeah. It's not, improvisation is not about being funny, clever, witty, good, bad, right or wrong. It's just about being. The period comes after the word be. All you have to do is exist. We're already inherently funny. Most people have a great sense of humor. So you don't need, there's something that happens when people get up on this 3-inch stage that they can't, multitask. And everybody multitasks every single day of their life. You'll be in the kitchen making dinner, getting ingredients out of the fridge, reading a magazine and a cookbook and feeding the cat while talking on the phone. But you don't think about any of that stuff. But when you improvise, for some reason, something happens in human nature where you get up on stage and you're asked to do one thing or several things and you freeze because you want it so bad. You want to be so good and you want to be right. And as an artist, your greatest assets are your mistakes. But as a human being, you don't want to make any.
So how are we going to free ourselves? How am I going to free myself up of not wanting to make a mistake and letting go of having to be good?
That's for you to decide.
If I was in your class, what would you tell me?
Just to get out of your own way, to eliminate self. You have a lot of self that you bring to the table. Not just you, everybody. But you want to eliminate self. You're not you. You're a character.
Okay, let's go.
You're Jimmy the character.
All right.
I love you.
I love you too, Bob. I really do.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to see you again.
It's good to see you.
It's been really a long time.
Yeah.
I have great memories of us together.
Yeah.
I remember what an asshole you were. Just that one time, though.
Okay.
But I really have a strong memory of that one time you were an asshole.
Yeah, I know. I was really pissed. I was pissed at you.
All right.
Okay?
Well,
and that's why I haven't talked to you in 10 years.
Well, had I known that, I would have, you know, approached you maybe by reaching out, giving you a call or an email. I mean, I would love nothing more than, you know, to hang out with you some more.
I'm not so sure if I'd want the same thing.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
You're not going to hit me, are you?
I wasn't thinking about hitting you.
Because that's how it started. That's how it started 10 years ago.
Well, that was a joke. I didn't...
The lights were out. It was at Beth's party.
I was trying to scare you.
What, jumping up behind me?
Yeah.
I scare very easily, Bob.
It was a joke.
I went to the hospital. I had 14 stitches.
It was a joke. Isn't that funny?
No, it's not funny.
14, look, no. You're laughing now. 14 stitches is hilarious.
Okay, it was funny, Bob. It was funny. I have a great sense of humor.
And a scar.
Yeah.
To prove it.
Yeah, right here, Bob. Right here.
There you go. Yeah. Look at that. Isn't that nice? Yeah. I am responsible for that. Yeah. You will take me with you to your grave.
Thank you.
Which we could make happen a lot sooner if you'd like.
That's a joke, Bob. But come on, I thought we were getting closer. I thought we were bonding right there.
Well, all right. Then I apologize. You're right.
For that or what you did 10 years ago?
Well, I'm not sorry for that.
You're a bigger asshole than I was that night.
Yes, I am. And I'm damn proud of it.
Good.
Because I wanted to be better than something than you were. So I'm a better asshole than you are.
Well, you know what?
No, I don't. If I did, I wouldn't. You wouldn't have to
Good,
ask
you
me that
won.
Question.
You won. Okay? You're a better asshole than I was.
It's
You're
not
better.
About winning.
What are you? You try to fuck with my head.
Yeah.
10 years. You come. I haven't seen you in 10 years, and the first thing you want to do is fuck my head. Fuck me in my head.
Isn't it?
It's great. It's great.
It's fun.
I love you, Bob. I missed you.
Well, let's do this again in 10 years.
No. I want you to come in. I want you to meet my wife and my kids.
You're married?
Yeah.
I missed your wedding. Oh, my God. Now I feel terrible.
I didn't invite you. I was still mad at you.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Oh, Jim. I'm going to get you a wedding present.
Bob, don't. You don't have to.
Yeah.
You've really done enough.
No, I'm seriously going to buy you something.
No, Bob,
I'll give you another scar for your wedding. How about if I scar your wife in the exact same place so you match? I'm kidding!
Okay, because I thought you were serious for a second.
No, come on!
I was going to slug you, because...
You can if you want.
No.
I'll give you a free shot. Go ahead.
A lot of pressure. Bob?
Jim?
I've never hit anybody in my whole life.
Well, it's about time then. It's about time you grew up and became a man by hitting somebody.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'm ready. Are you just going to look at me like that? You're an asshole, Bob. You're a fucking asshole.
I'm a better asshole than you.
Fuck! Ow, that hurt.
That felt great.
You're bleeding, man.
That's all right.
You're bleeding from your nose.
Yeah, but you did it.
It doesn't feel good, Bob.
I'm proud of you.
It was stupid. I shouldn't have done it.
Oh.
I shouldn't have. You always tricked me into doing something that I regret later. Damn it, Bob.
Isn't that fun?
No. No, it's not. I'm an accountant now, Bob. I'm a CPA. CPAs don't hit their friends. I'm a father. I've been married.
I think you're missing the boat.
What am I missing here, Bob?
You should have been a fighter.
Really?
A pretty good... Yeah.
My hand still stings. What? Look at it. It's all red.
Well, not much redder than this.
Okay. What am I doing? That was so stupid of me. I'm stupid.
Jeez. Why did you become so self-deprecating? You used to be one of the most confident guys I ever knew.
I lost it after the second kid. I'm not a good dad. My kids, they sass back to me. They don't listen to what I have to say. The oldest, Jessica.
Maybe you ought to smack those kids around a little bit.
I've tried that, Bob. But you know what they do? They hit me back.
Well.
They hit me back, Bob.
Don't start crying, because I'll smack the shit out of you. And give you something to cry about.
They hit me. Have you ever been hit by an 8-year-old girl?
Yeah.
It hurts. It really hurts, Bob.
Only if it's your little girl.
I'm a failure, Bob.
Aw, Jim, come on.
No, Bob, I'm a failure.
Jim.
I'm a fucking failure, Bob.
Jim, don't make me hit you again.
Hit me. I deserve it, Bob. I deserve it. Look at the pussy I am. Ah!
Stop it! Now you stop it right now!
God, that felt great. It's so fucking good! My wife and I, we haven't had sex in 4 years.
You should get her to smack you around a little bit.
I've been asking her to do it, Bob. She won't do it.
Get into that S&M stuff, man. You need to go buy some toys.
Man, that was great. That was fucking Do it again. I haven't gotten high. I haven't gotten high since I've seen you. I haven't gotten high.
So I feel the endorphin. Right,
oh, I feel stoned, Bob. Well. I feel like I could do something crazy. I could do something crazy. Oh, man, I could do something crazy. Oh, fuck these bushes. Fuck them. Did you see what I did?
Yeah.
I'm
gonna
turn it out of the ground. You know how much that was? You know how much I pay the gardener?
I have no idea.
$1,200. $1,200. And I'm sure that motherfucking Mexican is fucking my wife. He's fucking my wife. Oh, I got back then.
Well, at least she's getting it from somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, Bob, we gotta do something crazy. We gotta do something crazy.
I think we are doing something
crazy. Okay.
Okay,
great. Okay.
This whole thing
Look at this.
Pretty crazy.
I'm gonna take this bush out all by myself. I'm gonna take it out all by myself, Bob.
Okay.
Fucking bush. You know what she wanted? She said, you gotta get a bush. You gotta get a bush, you gotta get a bush, and it's gotta cover the window so nobody comes and robs us. Nobody steals from us.
Uh-huh.
That's bullshit, Bob.
Yeah, that's insecurity
that's
right there.
That's bullshit.
That's
insecurity.
That's a fear-based mentality that has no business in your life.
Help me, Bob. Help me, please. Come on. Help me, Bob. Fucking tree! Oh no! I pinned it to the ground, Bob. Oh, I got it by its throat. Oh, I'm gonna choke it. I'm choking it, Bob. I'm fucking choking this motherfucking thing. Oh, I did it. I fucking choked that tree. Boom, boom. Shoot, boom. Oh, I should have taken karate. I should have listened to you. I should have fucking listened to you.
Now that's the gym I remember.
Oh my God, that felt great. Wow. Oh, my God.
It's really good to see you, my
it's
friend.
Good to see you, Bob.
Jeez.
You brought it back.
Yes,
you
I
brought
did.
The old, you brought the old me back. Oh, my God, that was good.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
You're like a new man.
Oh, my God.
You've been reborn.
Oh, my God.
You have a new religion.
Yes. I owe you, Bob. I owe you. I owe you.
You don't
whatever
owe
you
me.
Want, you can have. You can have anything you want, Bob. I owe you.
I want to fuck your wife.
You can fuck her.
Great.
She's in the house. Tell her that I said you could have anything you want, and it's oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay?
Sure.
All right.
Get off your knees,
no,
man.
No. I owe you. You're a god to me.
All right, let's both get on our knees.
We're going to pray together?
Pray?
I'm praying to you. Bob, I've been praying for something like this to happen my whole life.
Well, it happened, so you got your wish. Your prayers have been answered.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
From the bottom of my heart, you are welcome.
And I can only imagine after you fuck my wife, the joy and the abundance I'm going to start to feel.
Both of us.
Yeah.
This
the first time. I'm winded. I am totally.
That was quite
winded.
A workout for you, wasn't it?
Yes. So what did you think of that?
I had a blast. It's not, like I said, it's the greatest drug in the world.
Now, did you get high off that?
Hell yeah.
How does it compare to marijuana?
It's about the same. It's about the exact same thing. It just stimulates that part of your brain. Acting, improv, doing movies, television, anything you're really passionate about, that's what excites you.
How does how do you put sex in there? A category of sex.
They're endorphins as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you, when you do an improv scene, do you go back and say, okay, I could have done this better or that better? Or
Not anymore. Well, I mean, I'll relive it, but only okay, for so, the, I use, okay, let's put it this way. I used to relive it for the failures. Now I relive it for the successes.
How have you been able to do that? Because I don't do that.
I've rewired my brain by working on myself so that I'm more confident in my life, and I just practice these principles of...
And what is that? Because I feel, knowing you, like the talking to you in the last... we had a pre-interview and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's a spiritual side that I've never seen before that
yeah,
you've been
true.
Developing.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Because you bring it to your teaching as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For sure. Well, I mean, it all goes back. I can only credit the stuff that I've done at Landmark Education. Doing
which
the
is the forum,
yeah,
which was
yeah.
asked. Yeah.
Yep, doing that whole curriculum was, you know, I really bottomed out at one time. I was on According to Jim, and Jim and I had a fight, and I got fired, and then that was like...
When you look back at that, was it your fault?
It doesn't even matter. No,
okay.
No. I don't even want to discuss it. It doesn't matter whose okay. fault it was, because even if I... get to the source of the blame, what difference does it make if I'm right? It
okay,
doesn't
okay.
serve any purpose.
Mike, we don't need to get into details.
Right.
What part of it did you felt you bottomed out on? Not the
it was
specifics.
Just, it was just my whole life. It had nothing to do with Jim. It was just my own life path.
Okay.
And so, and we've since made up, and we are good friends, and whenever I see him, you know, it's big hugs, and I really love the guy. He's been very generous to me over the years, so I want everybody to know that.
Okay.
And I really do love the guy. He's great. But for me, my life's journey was, I wanted to change. I don't want to live like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it started with Landmark Education, and then my wife did it. So we had that in common and shared that, and we were on this path of spiritual growth together, and we formed a mastermind group, and we would all get together once a month. You'd declare what you're up to, and then you're held accountable. So you have to show up either saying what you accomplished or what you failed at. And then I started the mastermind group, we started reading a lot of books together. One was The Success Principles by Jack Canfield, who mm-hmm. wrote all the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. That was a great book. There's one part, Jack Canfield talks about his mentor, was a guy named W. Clement Stone, who was an entrepreneur from Illinois, ironically enough. And W. Clement Stone lived his whole life under the premise that the world was conspiring in his favor, which just another thing that rocks my world. Instead of going around in life thinking that the world is conspiring against you, if you can what if to the negative, oh my God, what if, you know, like you're in a car and somebody almost hits you and they go, yeah, motherfucker almost hit me. What if he would have hit me, he could have killed it. Well, he didn't. Maybe he just didn't see you. Maybe his kid's in the hospital and he's got to go to the emergency room. Who knows? It doesn't matter. So why are you going to put all this energy into something that might have, should have, or could have happened instead of being in the moment, in the present moment, that nothing did happen. So just go on your way. And so the success principles then, now I'm a really huge Abraham Hicks fan.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry and Esther Hicks. Esther channels this being Abraham. It has nothing to do with religion. And it's all about law of attraction. As a matter of fact, everybody knows about The Secret. And The Secret was born out of this Australian documentary maker who went on a cruise ship to do a documentary on Jerry and Esther Hicks and the teachings of Abraham. And when they finished the documentary, Jerry and Esther Hicks asked to be removed because they wanted to keep their own brand name, not because anything was really wrong, but that's what became The Secret. So Jerry and Esther Hicks are the genesis of The Secret.
And so I just went to a Abraham Hicks seminar about 4 weeks ago for, I think it was like the second or third time. I watched a lot of the seminars online, some of them live, some of them pre-taped. I listened to the tapes. My wife and I both are religiously listen to the Abraham Hicks meditations every night before we go to sleep. She also listens to them every morning when she wakes up. And these are just some of the things that sent me on those paths. And I highly recommend all of this stuff.
And how has that affected your improv and your teaching?
Oh, my God. Like I just said, now I just relive the successes because that's all there is. There's nothing I can go back and change in what we just did here. So why would I even want to think about
something
that went
wrong?
When
you look at this scene, and you're reliving the successes, tell me what successes you're reliving.
Those moments that were exciting for both of us. Whenever I see you start laughing in the middle of a scene and your upper lip is sweating profusely because we're having so much fun and exciting co-creating that it's just magical. It's the greatest drug in the world. And the audience laughing is just icing on the cake. It just tells you that you're on the right track because they're feeding off the energy that you and I are creating by our co-creation. And it's those moments I talked about whenever those three points of focus come together. The audience is riveted, whether it's a funny moment or it's not a funny moment. Those are the things that really make improvisational magic.
So looking back at that, where were those three points coming together?
The scar moment, you showed the scar. The idea that, first of all, it was exploring and heightening the relationship between two people, starting out by saying, I love you,
right,
was a magical moment right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't expect that.
No.
I didn't expect that, and the audience didn't expect that. I don't know what they were expecting, but whatever they were expecting was not that. And comedy is surprise. So surprise comes out of being in the moment and allowing that discovery to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of the moments.
I thought you did a great job. I mean, you agreed to everything on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything. I thought you just did a great job of agreeing.
Thanks.
Is there times where it's okay not to agree?
Oh, yeah. Anger is definitely not necessarily agreement, correct?
Right.
But it's a great tool because it's the most coveted human emotion.
Why are improvisers afraid to go there, to the anger?
Because people often in life don't want to go to the anger. So they want to create something magical and they think something magical always happens only out of happiness. When you don't go to Disneyland and get pissed off. It just doesn't work. And it really comes down to, and what it's all about is pretending. We're pretending, right? We were pretending we're people, which is playing a children's game. And what makes the distinction between what works and what doesn't is we're playing a children's game, but you have to play a children's game by children's rules. You can't play a children's game by adult rules. It's not fun. It doesn't work. It may work from time to time, and you may have hit or miss moments. But unless you're playing a children's game by children's rules, which means getting back in touch with the innocence and vulnerability that we were all born with, then you're not having fun from moment to moment to moment to moment. So the anger thing is fine as long as you're having fun by playing a children's game by children's rules. You see, if you say to a child, let's play house, they just go and play. They let the game decide whether they're the mom or the dad, whether they're in the bedroom or the kitchen. If you say to an adult, let's play house, they go, okay, you want me to be the mommy or the daddy? Because we need to conceptualize before we give ourselves permission to play the game. And when you get rid of that, eliminate self, then you just start playing the game and let the game teach you. And that's why I don't even like taking suggestions anymore, because they're meaningless.
Well, I had a blast, especially pulling those trees up. I mean, I'm exhausted, you know? So,
well, I had a blast improvising with you. This is a great show. I'm really proud of you.
Thank you.
Your 11th season. Congratulations. Yeah. It's
right.
Amazing.
Well, I had some shame because you asked me before. You're like, 11 seasons. How? It's only been 3 years.
Well, don't stop shaming.
Okay.
Stop the shaming.
Okay.
Don't do that to yourself. See, you take yourself out of the game before you give yourself a chance to play, and that's what you were asking me before we started improvising. Don't take yourself out of the game. Just play. Even when you're not improvising, just play. I just got done. You know, what's really important about this work is that you walk the walk and not just talk the talk. There's a lot of teachers who talk the talk but don't walk it. And so we can, you know, I sold everything I owned and went to Europe and just traveled around the world for a year, literally improvising my life.
You had no plans? You didn't know where you were going to go?
No, other than the fact that I was going to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, and after that, I had no idea, none whatsoever. We made plans as we went along, and it was one of the most amazing years of my life.
Because I could never do that. I could never do that.
I encourage you to do it.
All right.
Read some of those books.
Well, I am. I'm reading the Tom Booker, Write It and It Comes or something like that.
Oh, Asking It Is Given?
Yes.
I love that book.
Yeah.
I've read it about 10 times.
I got to read because
that's my Bible. It's a great book. That's a Jerry and Esther Hicks book.
We're going to turn the house lights out and get some questions for you. All right?
Okay. Yeah,
great.
Sure. I'd love it.
All right. Right here? Is the mic on?
Hello?
Hello?
Testing?
There.
Testing.
Okay, great.
Hi.
Great.
Hi.
So I actually also...
What's your name?
My name's Joshua.
Hi, Joshua.
Glad to meet you. So I actually did the Landmark Forum with my girlfriend, all the curriculum, and then we also sold all of our belongings and went improvised and took an indefinite trip around the country.
Awesome.
Isn't
that amazing?
I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
So I'd actually like to know, and she and I have had extensive conversations about this, but what exercises from the Landmark Forum have you, like practical things have you applied to either your teaching or your improv that are from Landmark Forum or anything that you learned on your trip around the world?
I'll tell you, that question could only be answered in what I don't do anymore. And what I don't do anymore is live in a story of I'm not good enough, I could never do that, I shouldn't, I won't, have self-doubt about something. And so that has been completely removed from my existence and way of being. Do I fall into it now and then? Absolutely. But the difference is before when I would dwell on it for, you know, whether it be minutes, hours, days, weeks, or months, now I get off of it before you even recognize that I'm on it. And that's a landmark technology term, actually.
Yeah.
Great. Let's another question. Right here.
How you doing? My name's Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How you doing? My question early was you tapped
Tom,
on
Tom, can
it.
You speak into the mic?
Is this good right here?
Yeah. Is that you getting it? Great.
I feel like swinging it around.
Well, it's our first time we're using it.
I know. It's really uncomfortable, too. But anywho, what I was...
Tom, you're on.
Thank you. You tapped on it a bit earlier where... scenes would take a little longer to develop and really get more into depth. And now it seems like everything's really super fast-paced, things like that. Would you attribute it to more people, how they do improvise today, or is it just pressure to be funny, or what would you really, or is that an evolution of things now? How would you attribute that?
Yeah, I think it's mostly the evolution of things, and with technology, you know, and the internet, and stand-up comedy, and everything is fast and immediate. Like, you don't even have to, you know, look up things anymore or research things anymore because it's all right on your cell phone. Everybody has an iPhone. You can Google anything. You used to have intimate conversations about debates on whether this is right or not. Now you just Google it and you're right immediately because everybody has that capability. So it's taking that off the table. So now everybody's into how quickly, how much can we get done and how fast can we do it? It's just like I think, working for a living, people who do jobs, who actually have jobs, there used to be career waiters, you know, people who took pride in their jobs and worked at a restaurant for 50 years, and there's a few of them around, but nowadays it's just a paycheck to get to whatever else you want to do. And so because that's been taken off the table, now everybody's doing something to get somewhere else. It's not in and of itself satisfying enough to just be there and do that. And that's why being in the now, Eckhart Tolle, you know, the power of now, is just good enough. It's just good enough to be right here, right now, and enjoying this conversation.
Great. Another question? Right over here.
Hi. I wanted to just ask about...
What's your name?
I'm Lauren.
Lauren! It's Jimmy Corain's wife.
Yes.
Yay!
Hi.
We love Lauren.
In the scene that you guys did, it seemed like you were changing your point of view a lot. Like, it started out with different... You know, one of the things I've heard from watching your show so much is about, you know, sticking to your same point of view. And I was wondering how you felt about, did your characters shift point of view too much, or were you okay with it? I guess it's for both of you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I get to answer all the questions.
Okay. I think it's okay. I think it's about transformation.
Yeah, it is.
And
right.
So I think a lot of people today feel that they have to stay in one point of view and not change. So I like doing it. I like changing emotions. Especially if you're going to do a 10-minute scene.
Well, it's a twofold answer for me. I think it's a great learning technique when you're at a beginning, intermediate level of improvisation to stay on the same level. And when you become more advanced, then you can flow in and out of it quicker, effortlessly. And I like the changing of points of views because that's like a roller coaster ride, right? And that's what allows, you know, when you're on a roller coaster, the thrill going up is fun because you're anticipating the thrill of going down. And it's the same in an improv scene. So we're going up at certain points, getting the exposition out so we can have the thrill of going down when everybody makes that discovery and those three points of focus come together that I keep talking about, that changes the energy in the room and everybody laughs because it's an excitement of everybody being in the ensemble, whether they're on stage with you or not. And to me, that's a really exciting part of improvisation.
Great. Another question?
Hi. My name is Joseph.
Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Mark. In discovering your partner, I notice it's slow comedy. So you kind of have to agree and wait for it and see where you are. Is there so much as a who, what, where, and when so much in the beginning that you have to establish still, or you just speak about?
Yeah, no, it's very important to establish that. But if it's a similar answer to Lauren's question here is at the beginning of your education, you want to make sure that you are aware of the who, what, and where's and all of that information. But when you become a more experienced improviser, because I keep talking about it, our muscles are much stronger than a lot of people who have not been doing this stuff as long, that we can inherently get to the who, what, and where through exposition of improvising rather than having to establish it very clearly before we can go on to the story. So it's inherent in our story because we're very experienced improvisers that we can get out the exposition in the context of improvising rather than having to get the who, what, and where. Like I said, that's the difference between playing a children's game by children's rules and playing a children's game by adult rules. When you play a children's game by adult rules, you need to conceptualize and get all the information before you give yourself permission to play the game. When you're playing by children's rules, you just play the game and you let the game decide all the rules. So we're more along the lines of playing by children's rules where we're allowing the game to decide all those variables rather than having to decide the variables before we play the game.
Great. Another question? Right here.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Taylor.
Hi, Taylor.
Hello. I really loved what you said about reliving your successes and counting your successes, and I'm curious how that relates to your experience as a teacher. Like, how do you define success as a teacher? What moments do you go back to where you know you were successful?
Well, as a teacher, because, you know, Jimmy mentioned transformation. I love teaching transformation. That's what this work is all about. So I like the tentativeness of the beginning of the class where people aren't quite clear about who I am, and they don't know me, they don't know each other. And then by the end of the class, there's a very strong trust and ensemble feel. And there's three levels of trust. You have to first trust the work, then you have to trust each other, and the most challenging is you have to trust yourself. And when you start to trust yourself, then all of the other variables kind of fill in. And, you know, the way I've restructured and retrained my brain to experience life is, like, you know, I haven't read the newspaper in years. You know, I know what's going on in the world. Basically, anything that happens is posted on Facebook anyways. So I find myself even more informed than I ever have before by just being present to listening. So what I really like at the end of a workshop is watching the transformation of where people had not the knowledge that I speak of before we started. They have a lot of knowledge, so much knowledge that they can't even process it all during the class. And then in weeks and months later, that they have these epiphanies of things that they heard but didn't quite grasp. And the most exciting thing for me about teaching is making sure that the entire class does not sleep that night, because they're so excited and so high from the experience of the class that they can't stop thinking about all the stuff they learned, and you just can't sleep because you're just really high. That, to me, is really exciting.
Great. We've got to wrap this up.
No.
Yes, this has been so much
fun.
Say
it's not so.
Yes, yes.
Jimmy, I don't want to go.
I don't either. What one piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
One piece of advice. God, I've said so much of it already. The one piece of advice, I think, is to just get out of your own way. Stop thinking. It's the thinking that takes you out of the game. And you can't take yourself out of the game before you give yourself a chance to play. So you just want to play. So stop thinking and start listening. And the way you do that, the way you accomplish that, is by replacing all of your wants, needs, and desires with your partner's wants, needs, and desires. And if you're making taking care of them more important than taking care of yourself, then you'll be completely taken care of.
And what does that look like? Because that term, taking care of your partner, making your partner look good, has gotten so diluted over the years. Mm-hmm. What does that mean specifically?
Watch the scene we just did.
Okay, give me an example from that scene how either I took care of you or you took care of me.
Just listening. Just listening. That's it. All you have to do is listen to and react. Acting is reacting. And you can't react unless you're listening. The great Charles Durning, when asked what acting was, said, "Acting is listening. If you're not listening, I don't know who is."
That's a great way to end. Mark Beltzman, thank you so much
thank
for being
you,
our
Jimmy.
Guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, the Mark Beltzman episode. And I want to thank our guest, Mark Beltzman. And I loved it when he was talking about bottoming out with Jim Belushi, and then how he then found spirituality and got to the Forum, and then the works of the Hickses. It was just, I just loved it. I just loved it. It was very inspirational. So I want to thank our guest, Mark Beltzman. I want to thank Stage 773 here in Chicago. They are our home base. They are the people that make us feel like such rock stars. I want to thank them. Also, our producer, Dan Schiffmacher, here in Chicago, who makes these episodes sound so slick and so professional. You wouldn't be hearing my voice right now if it wasn't for Dan. Also, if you want more information about me, that's me, Jimmy Corain, in our improv blog. Every week, I will send you a blog that will make you a better improviser and maybe a better person. That part is up to you. Also, we have books and we have Improv Nerd t-shirts and classes. So just go to the website, jimmycorain.com. We're also part of this wonderful podcast collective at feralaudio.com. We're on there with Chelsea Peretti, Todd Barry, Dan Harmon, Matt Dwyer. I mean, the list go on and on. I could continue to name drop, but I don't need to. Just go to feralaudio.com. We're also taking over. We are totally taking over social media. So go to our fan page on Facebook and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter. It's improv_nerd. And also, we have a YouTube channel, so check that out as well. I want to thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. He's a nerd.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I
don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My